Okay, guys. Don't worry. I'm sorry. Okay, tonight is a special share, so there are no sheets. So, sheets. Okay. So, tonight in Meiros, we about, depending upon your estimates, 650,000 maybe people gathering in Meiros for Shimon Bar Yochai's Lag BaOmer event. And there'll probably be about 4 million people rolling their eyes at this event and saying, what does this all mean? It's all just hocus-pocus, paganism, outdated witchcraft, and all these people are essentially medievalists who have landed in our modern world. So, to the degree that some of those people rolling their eyes are from people, I want to take the opportunity just to give you a sense of what Kabbalah is. I'm not a Mekubal, I don't practice Kabbalah. What does Kabbalah mean to me? A lot of people, when they see the scenes, and the scenes are a little bit abrasive and a little bit foreign, and fires and people congregating in large masses and sacrificing animals, and it becomes an opportunity to take pot shots and to chas v'shalom disparage the whole world of Kabbalah, the whole world of Sod, and it's uninformed, it's ignorant, it's simply untrue, and of course it's heresy, but it's only not in any way part of our Masar. Okay, so you can title this year, what does Kabbalah mean for non-Mekubalim? And it doesn't have much to do with Lag BaOmer. This is a shiur in general. Lag BaOmer and Shimon Bar Yochai, the relationship between him and that day may or may not be accurate, may or may not be correct, maybe it's a typo. But the real question is, it's happening, people are going, we're not going, I'm not opposed if you want to go, but what do you make of the world of Kabbalah, not just in Lag BaOmer, but the other 364 days of the year as well? What's happening first? Why is there this antipathy or this alienation from the world of Kabbalah? And then we'll just establish some of the terms of Kabbalah. What does Kabbalah mean? And then we'll talk about what does Kabbalah mean for me? How do I use Kabbalah to frame and to inform my Avodas Hashem? Okay, so three different parts. I think we're living in a world in which religion, let's first focus on the Jewish world, the world of Jewish religion, the Torah world, the yeshiva world, has decided to focus, set up camp almost exclusively in the world of Nigla. The world of Nigla is Halacha, Lamdus, Tanakh, Machshava. Right now I'm going to use these terms similarly. They're very different terms, empiricism and rationalism. They're very different terms. I'll differentiate between them soon. That's a product of the yeshiva world that we're all deriving from. Rav Chaim Volozhin built the yeshiva world, and Torah was at a period of a lull, and he tried to re-implement Torah learning at a broad scale by founding the modern yeshivas. And that Torah learning, if you would travel back in time and you were just learning with the Vilna Gaon, of course you'd be learning Kabbalah. If you travel back in time, 400 years, you're just in your local town learning with Yerav, people were always learning Kabbalah. But the yeshiva world moved towards the world of Nigla, and to a degree, that movement was based on Hasidus adopting Kabbalah. So the polarization between the yeshiva world and Hasidus led to a little bit of a distancing in the yeshiva world from the world of Kabbalah, but it wasn't just the sore meiraz where, the Hasidim, they're practicing Kabbalah, and we don't want to be Hasidus because that's dangerous, but also more of an activist stress and emphasis upon the world of Nigla. So living in the year 2019, we're not studying Sefer HaZohar, we're not studying Sefer Yetzirah, we're not studying the works of Chaim Vital, the works of the Ari. Most people in classic non-Kabbalah yeshivas, I'm not talking about Kabbalistic yeshivas, this is for you guys, not for the yeshivas in Tzvah. We're not studying Re'ed and Mehemet, we're not studying Sefer HaChalos. That's number one. Number two, we live in a broader world. What's happening in the broader world? So first of all, in the broader world, there's a very, very deep and latent suspicion for all the witchcraft of the ancient world. So many shifts have occurred in our scientific paradigms. The world isn't flat. There's natural selection that drives human evolution. There's a microbial world that's responsible for infection that can be tamed. Thank God we live in the world of science. Thank God we live in the world of reason. And there's a natural bias towards the ancient world. They were all hocus-pocus witchcraft fools operating in some world of magic and mysticism. And there's this almost this bias towards non-rational, non-scientific, which is particularly accentuated in the modern world of rationalism. And again, I'm using that term, hyper-rationalism, and empiricism. I think these two phenomena, A, if either of these phenomena were to exist, it would lead to a bit of a bias against Kabbalah, but together it leads, in particularly amongst yeshiva bachrim who aren't informed, to a very strongly articulated bias, and again, saying things that are simply ridiculous. Okay? Every single person, almost every single person in our Masara studied Kabbalah. I forget, practiced Kabbalah. We'll see that in a moment. The Rashba studied Kabbalah, wrote a sefer on Kabbalah. Ramban studied Kabbalah, wrote a sefer on Kabbalah. The Ravid studied Kabbalah, wrote a sefer on Kabbalah. Shulchan Aruch, Beis Yosef, studied Kabbalah, wrote a sefer on Kabbalah. The Ramah studied Kabbalah, wrote a sefer on Kabbalah. The Maharal is based on Kabbalah. Vilna Gaon, based on Kabbalah. Rosh Hashem Lasato, based on Kabbalah. What about the Rambam? Now, the Rambam doesn't speak about Kabbalah much, and we'll talk a little bit about the discrepancy between some of the Rambam's strongly held opinions and certain ideas in Kabbalah, so a certain amount of discrepancy. Whether he thought it was heresy or not, that's very extreme. But let's, for argument's sake, because that's a scholarly debate, what the Rambam's view of Kabbalah was. If Cook once said that HaKadosh Baruch Hu hid Kabbalah from the Rambam, and the Rambam accessed HaKadosh Baruch Hu through ways that Kabbalah grants other access to. But let's, for argument's sake, say that the Rambam didn't study Kabbalah. The overwhelming majority of our Masara, the overwhelming majority, we'll talk about this, did. So the question of whether the Rambam did or didn't is an interesting point academically. If you're a biographer of the Rambam, what was the Rambam's position on Kabbalah? Did the Rambam have access to Kabbalah? But in terms of trying to be part of our Masara and appreciate the layers of our Masara, it's almost an irrelevant point. Moshe Feinstein once said, you could write a sefer of all the minority opinions of all the great Gedolim and come up with a book that's antithetical to Torah. You take this, his shita on that, his shita on that, his shita on Ashkenazi Pradas, his shita. There's a general Masara that has aggregated over the last 1,000 years of what our belief system is, of what Torah is, you can find the famous shita of Haral Bag on whether Hashem has foreknowledge about the falling leaf. Hashem doesn't care about a little leaf falling off of a tree. You can find, but basically those have been not debunked, but have been discarded. There's a general sense of what we believe in as a people with room for flexibility. And it's clear that in general, overwhelmingly, all of the great leaders of our Masara studied Kabbalah. Many of them wrote Svarim of Kabbalah. We've moved away, as I described, over the last 200 years. So whether the Rambam did or didn't, it's an interesting point, but I don't think it bears upon this conversation. You're not going to build your entire system according to the Rambam. Much of our system is built on the Rambam. Okay, that out of the way. What is Kabbalah and where does it originate? Those are two separate questions, okay? An inappropriate definition of Kabbalah is mysticism. Kabbalah studies the relationship between our world and worlds you can't see. Worlds through which HaKadosh Baruch Hu's infinite and non-physical, uncontainable, indescribable essence slowly evolves and unfurls into this world. How do you get everything in reality is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu? There's nothing in this world that isn't from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. How does that happen? HaKadosh Baruch Hu isn't a table. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't have molecules. HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't have atoms. There's nothing physical. How do you get an infinite presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and all of a sudden develop a cup of soda? How does that happen? Or a sefer, or a thought, or a statement, or an idea, or a phrase? There's a slow unfolding through worlds and within each world through lattices that are called sephiros. And Kabbalah studies how HaKadosh Baruch Hu unfolds or his presence translates into our material world. And it tries to find HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence in our world, even in areas and experiences that are not typically seen by the non-Kabbalistic world. Where do I find Hashem? Where do I put on my tefillin? Where do I find Hashem? When I put on tzitzis, when I study Torah, when I make a bracha, when I perform a mitzvah, when I avoid an aveira, when I think about a kodesh bracha, what about out there? Shem's there, Shem's in a tree, not a spirit, but Shem's responsible for the tree, Shem's responsible for the glass of water, Shem's responsible for the oceans and the hills and the mountains. And it tries to locate and identify Shem's presence because it takes a broader view of how this world was triggered, or was created, triggered, but how this world was created by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. That unfurling is called Hishtalshelut, and the worlds, or the lattice network by which Hashem's presence trickles down, is the best word, Hishtalshelut, is called Sefiros. Different, like a lattice network. I'm not going to describe the oppositional forces within Sefiros, the male side, the female side, the fact that there are oppositional forces in the universe, in the cosmos, and Kabbalah tries to unify and merge those forces. That's already the details of Kabbalah. Now, that is, listen carefully, a rational experience. You can study it. You can apply your mind. It's not empirical because I can't prove it. I can't trace it. If I want to study a molecule of water, that's empirical. I take a molecule of water, deconstruct it, put it under the microscope, look at its molecular structure, conduct scientific experimentation on it. I can't see these worlds. I can't prove they're delivered truths. I have to accept the way these worlds were constructed based on the Masorah of Kabbalah. So it's not empirical. Empirical means I can prove it based on the data available. It's not scientific in that sense, but it's rational. The process itself is, where are the worlds, how are they composed, how do the worlds interact, how does Hashem unfurl, what? It's not mystical, it's rational. And the Ramban was a rationalist, and the Rashi said, they weren't mystics. Too often people make that leap, oh, it's Kabbalah, it's mystical. It's not mystical, it's rational, it's thought, it's study, and typically, we'll talk about when it originated, it was only reserved for the elite minds, for certain people who could handle it, there was a danger in it, it was playing with fire. But you sat down and you studied Kabbalah with your Rebbe, the same way you sit down and study Maseches Pesachim with your Rebbe. You didn't engage in a mystical experience. And in fact, most of Kabbalah, I shouldn't use the word Kabbalah, most of Torah's Hasod, because I'll talk about this in a moment, most of studying this whole world was very rational, was very cerebral, it wasn't empirical. Now, there are strains in this world primarily associated with a mystical Kabbalist named Rabbi Avram Abulefia in the 12th century of Spain, in which you don't just study Kabbalah, and you don't just study the world, and you don't just study your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, here's the word, you also try to bridge the distance between yourself and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's higher essences. That's where it becomes mystical. A non-mystic says, you know what, Hashem is different, he's not physical, I can't taste him, I can't see him, I can't touch him, I can't describe him, I can't imagine him. So I'll worship him, I'll study his word and his will, and I'll accept his authority based on that distance. That's called Yirat Shamayim. I submit to Hashem's authority, and I know, Ki lo machshevosai machshevosechem, velo darchechem derachayinu Hashem. He's in Shamayim, I'm on the Aretz, Hashamayim Shamayim Hashem, Ve'aretz Hasan of Adam, and I'll try to understand them and build the relationship based on mitzvos, based on study, based on davening to him, based on serving his people, based on living in his land, based on all that. Mystic says, that's not enough. I have to get closer to Hashem. How do you get closer to Hashem? You can't think of him, you can't describe him, you can't imagine. Okay, so suspend your ration and engage in a non-rational, experiential bonding with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And here are the tools to bond. It's not miniatures, it's not like as if no one practiced it, but that's not Kabbalah. Kabbalah isn't mysticism or mystical experience. Kabbalah is studying things which aren't empirical and receiving the truths from others, and that's a rational experience. There have always been strains, and Hasidus merges in, and Hasidus adopts one of them, to be clear. Hasidus doesn't just talk about the study, because again, many Hasidim couldn't study, but about the experience. But the Rashba didn't, and the Ramban didn't. They were just rational studiers of Torah says about Kodesh Baruch Hu's presence in these upper worlds and how it translates into our world. So don't make that mistake and immediately assume that Kabbalah or Sod, it's all mysticism. It's rational study of worlds that, of course, you can't see, which means you have to receive the tradition, like many things we receive. I'll talk about this a bit later. Okay, now, the first Svarim of Kabbalah appear after Shas. So Yechezkel, Perek Aleph, and Yechezkel, Perek Yud, talk about Maisa Merkava, Shem's chariot, Maisa Bereishis, which of course, according to the Rambam, is basically physics and metaphysics, so it's not anything beyond. Physics is the study of our world, metaphysics is the study of the thoughts that drive our world and how the world was created. But assuming we don't agree with the Rambam, so, and we have Oshia and Rebbe Chanina think, who sat every Erev Shabbos and studied Sefer HaYetzirah, so we'll talk about the various Svarim, and they fashion through the Sefer HaYetzirah a calf every Erev Shabbos to eat that Shabbos. The Svarim themselves only appear later. So for example, Sefer HaYetzirah is a Sefer that appears in the days of the Gaonim. These are the famous Svarim of Sod or Kabbalah.
And the word Kabbalah means many things to different people, so I keep avoiding it. But I'll just use it in general. When I say Kabbalah, I mean in general. What's another sefer? The sefer Habahir is a sefer that appears in the 12th century of France. The sefer HaZohar, most famous sefer, that first appears in the 13th century in Spain. So scholars will say, well, that's how all these traditions are. 13th century, 12th century, 6th century of the Gaonim. Aram Masara, when I say Aram Masara, based on the Mekubalim, these Svarim were hidden from human contact, but Kabbalah and the study of Kabbalah goes all the way back, not just to Har Sinai, but to Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu is the author of Sefer Yetzirah, or at least he was aware of Sefer Yetzirah, Rabbeinu Sajagon says, even a rationalist of Rabbeinu Sajagon. And Maisei Merkava, Maisei Bereishis, these were these incohate studies. There's no sefer called Maisei Bereishis or Maisei Merkava. These were the topics and the themes that were studied that later became articulated around the sefer, Sefer Habahir, or Sefer HaZohar, or Sefer HaYetzirah. Arba Nechnesu LaParadeis, four people entered the Paradeis, and they studied so, Rabbi Akiva, and Ben Azai, and Ben Zoma. And my Simir Kava, and the Surim, the Gemara Chagiga, not to study this until you're 40 years old, and not to study it in groups of more than, or less than this, and more than that. So, even though these Svar appear later on, they're attributed to parts of the Masara, they're attributed to parts of Tarjah, to an integral part of Tarjah Bapeh, and nowhere more so than the Sefer Azar. The Sefer Azar only appears in the 13th century of Spain, but it's attributed to primarily Rabbi Shimon and his son Eliezer's writings, and not just his son, but maybe 10 other people who are part of the authorship of the Sefer HaZohar. So if you ask an academic, what's the origin of Kabbalah, he'll say, well, when these Svarim appear. But if you ask him a Kubal, what's the origin, he'll say, well, these Svarim appear, but these ideas are already latent in Tarash and Balpeh, and were already studied by Chazal, and these Svarim, for whatever reason, only start to be canonized and written at a later point. Okay, so these are some of the confusing facts of Kabbalah. Is it mysticism? Is it not? When does it start? I was told the Sefer HaZohar was written in the 13th century. What does that mean about Kabbalah? It means the Sefer was written in the 13th century as an articulated Sefer. But the ideas were studied by Shimon bar Yochai. The ideas were studied by Yechezkel. The ideas were studied by Avraham Avinu. So I want to make sure I'm covering all the points. Okay. Final point, and then we'll talk about how Kabbalah can affect your life. Final point of just clarification. Shimon bar Yochai, the gravesite, Meron, Lag BaOmer, 700,000 people. We have documentation of people, when I say people, I mean Jews, I mean Muslims, visiting graves up north, dating back well before the 16th century, 11th century, 12th century, visiting the graves of Hillel and Shammai, visiting the graves of Shmuel HaNavi, visiting the grave of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, primarily for prayer, primarily to pray for water, primarily because there was some miraculous water supply in some rock between Hillel and Shammai's grave that everyone knew about, everyone came to receive spiritual waters, but supernatural waters. In Sefer HaZohar, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, one of his last words are, come to my grave on my Yom Hilula, come to me on my Yahrzeit day. We don't know from the Sefer HaZohar what his Yahrzeit day is. At some point, his Yahrzeit becomes associated with Lag BaOmer. Again, it may be written in the Zohar, there may be a typo, Yom Simchasi, Yom Shemesbo. He says it's the day of my happiness, Lag BaOmer, because everyone's happy Lag BaOmer. And if you take out the Ches, it's not Yom Simchasi, but Yom Shemesibo, the day that I died. The Chidah says that. It's not clear whether he died on Lag BaOmer. But what locks in Lag BaOmer as Rav Shimon bar Yochai's Yahrzeit, and that we come to the grave of Rav Shimon bar Yochai on Lag BaOmer, is the Ari HaKadosh. So the Ari HaKadosh, because, and remember, 16th century Spanish Jews, 16th century Spanish Jews are migrating from Spain in large numbers to Tzfat, to Meron, a lot of Kabbalah, a lot of Messianic thoughts, a lot of non-rational experience occurring in the wake of the great, great expulsion from Spain. Ari HaKadosh visits the grave around this time for 3 days, and that pretty much institutionalizes this grave on that day. But it's not an experience that starts in the 16th century. this whole experience of visiting the graves of these great people up north for some supernatural assistance wasn't just Jewish, and it wasn't something that happened specifically on Lag BaOmer with Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Now, what's happened in the modern world is, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, is it's called transportation. Going to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's grave used to be a 3-day trip, a 4-day trip, a 5-day trip, depending on where you live. So it was engaged, it was taken by people who understood the meaning, were locked into Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, were generally people who studied Kabbalah or people who lived in the area, and like any local miracle shrine, they visited it. Modern transportation means you can live in Be'er Sheva, or you can live in Eilat and spend your whole day on the beach, and then just get in a bus, and 10 hours later you're in Meron, and you're celebrating Shimon Bar Yochai. And it has converted something that used to be self-selective, by and large, into something which is mass. So you interview some of the people tonight, some of those 700,000 people, 600,000 people, some of them will be Mekubalim, and some of them will be people that really understand Kabbalah and engage in Kabbalah, either intellectually or experientially, and they understand the importance of Shimon Bar Yochai and Kabbalah. And some of them are just there because they know that it's an important day, or they heard it's an important day, it's a mass gathering. It's the largest gathering in the state of Israel. So that creates a lot of the dissonance and a lot of the cacophony. Like, you see people there that aren't dati and aren't religious, aren't really engaging in religious activities, and they're just there for the event, and they're just there to get some almost artificial or vicarious assistance from Shimon Bar Yochai. And I think that also creates a little bit of a distaste for some people. If you see a chassid there, his whole life he practices Kabbalah, it makes sense that he's going to visit the grave of the greatest mekubal on the day that's important, either his yahrzeit or otherwise. If you see some person who has no connection to Judaism or to religious Judaism, then he's there, it creates a little bit of a jarring image, and I'll talk about this maybe a little bit later. But if you go back 200 years and you stood by Rosh Hashanah and Bar Yochai's gravesite on Lag BaOmer, it wouldn't be so jarring. You see people making the journey with their camels, with their donkeys, with their food on their back for 4 or 5 days, and by and large, who showed up? The people that really understood its importance, its meaning, based on their overall lifestyles. So now all of a sudden it has this artificial, you land for 2 days and you build a tent and you sacrifice a calf or something or a goat, and then all of a sudden it doesn't seem right to many people. But it would be more studied and more dignified and more holistic if you went back 100 years before modern, or even 9800 years. There are pictures. You can go on the internet, wiki, Shimon Bar Yochai, you'll see pictures of Arabs, you'll see pictures of 20 people going on in their donkeys, 100 people gathering. It wasn't this mass movement with blazing fires and people throwing valuables into the fire. Anytime it becomes a mass movement, it's going to become diluted, it's going to become cheapened, and then in your mind, oh, that's Kabbalah. Kabbalah's all bunk, it's all hocus pocus, and everyone there is worshiping a bodhisattva. So I think, to put a little bit of perspective on the evolution and the modern incarnation of Lag BaOmer, Shimon Bar Yochai, based on changes in transportation and how that has changed the experience itself. Okay? That's really the first part of Shir. What's Kabbalah? What are the terms? Is it mystical? Is it rational? What are the svarim that are important? When did the svarim emerge? Even if the Rambam wasn't the Mekubal, overwhelmingly our Masorah studied Kabbalah, and it's part of Torah Shabbat, even though these svarim emerged much later, and scholars, of course, can't prove anything before the svarim emerged. That's the difference between scholarly documentation and a tradition. The question is as follows. Now that I've tried to clarify some of these terms, how can Kabbalah help your life? How does Kabbalah help my life? I'm not a practicing Mekubal, although there are certain points in my life I feel Kabbalah, and I'll iterate them. But how does Kabbalah affect me as a rationalist Jew, as a Jew that tries to learn, tries to perform mitzvahs, tries to perform chesed? I don't engage in those thoughts too often. How does it in some way enrich my life? What role does Kabbalah play? So aside from saying, you know what, it's important, there are people out there, but our world has moved away from it, and therefore we'll just know that it's... I really have two agendas tonight. One agenda is to take you from a space where you disparage it and mock it and scorn it to a place where it's part of a masara that we don't practice. Our world has shifted away from that masara. At the very least, say, you know, it's part of a masara. Rabban studied it, the Rashba studied it, the Bill Gaon studied it. But right now it's 2019, and there's enough in the world of Nigla for me to exhaust. You can live 30 lifetimes and not finish Maseches Pesachim. So you know what? I'll spend my time in Maseches Pesachim. I'll spend my time in Tanakh. I'll spend my time in Yeshaya. Because I know I can live 30 lifetimes and still not exhaust. If you can't come, you say, Rebbe, I finished Kol HaTorah Kula. I know all the Lamdas. I know all the Sfarim. I know Menachem Levy. I know it all. What should I do? Say, you know what? Go down the block to the Mekubal. Go get some alternate route to express your Avodas Hashem. The second agenda is, well, how can it affect us on the margins? I don't spend my time studying Kabbalah, but when I think about Kabbalah, when I read a piece of Kabbalah, when I see someone who's into Kabbalah, how do I process it rather than just say, oh, that's a different world? Yin and Yang. I'm the Yin rune, he's the Yang rune. We just never... Where's the convergence? Where's the cross-pollination? So let's talk about three or four issues. Number one, I use Kabbalah to think about ration and irration, science and its limitations. I actually tried to jot down a couple of notes. Number one, how do I acquire truth? We live in a world in which we assume that all truth has to be self-mediated. And any truth which can't be proven personally isn't a truth. I have to prove it for myself, and I can't accept. And we all know, even in the world of Nikla, these are all crossovers between Nistar and Nikla. We all know that wise people realize that certain truths have to be delivered. Can you prove Har Sinai? Can you prove Kriyas Yamsuf? Can you prove creation of the world? We have a Masara. Avram told his son, who told his son, who told his son, who told his son, Hashem created the world in 6 days. And Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim. And Hashem performed miracles. How do you know that the Svarim telling you Yamsuchim is true? How do you know that the Allah of the Posek? To relax that stiff intransigence in the modern society against delivered truths. There's this tendency in the modern world that if you follow people blindly, that's the pejorative word, you don't open your eyes and render judgments for yourself, you'll be exploited, you'll be manipulated, and wise people know that there's certain truths you can prove. Centuries here. Kabbalah is exactly such. Why is it called Kabbalah? Because it's a Kabbalah. You can't prove anything. In some way, if I wanted to, I could try to prove Har Sinai, because at least Har Sinai is here. So we could go to Har Sinai and find a leftover piece of the Luchos Abrus, and we could take it into the laboratory and prove that it's part of the Shnei Luchos Abrus. We can't, but in theory, it's provable. We just uncovered enough information or material. I can't go to the other worlds with you. They're not visible. They may not even be palpable. So it's a Kabbalah. I just have to accept. Rav Shimon bar Yochai passed on the tradition that he received. In some ways, dating back to Avraham Avinu, and passed it on to Shlomo. And it reminds me, even in my world of rational experience, that I won't be able to achieve them all through self-arbitration, and I have to accept certain truths about my Masara. And that's something you've heard from me before this year. This isn't new, but Kabbalah helps me frame that. Kabbalah helps me stabilize that. Number two, my experiences. What experiences do I value that are rational? Do I also value non-rational experiences? Well, non-rational doesn't have to be mystical. I don't necessarily go out and then levitate, or go out and all of a sudden transition or travel to other realms. But I know, for example, modern psychology has taught me a lot about myself and my psyche. And those aren't rational. And there are some important experiences that I undergo and that I encounter that aren't rational. And there are certain feelings I have that aren't rational, but are very transformative and very influential. And so it doesn't just make me think about how I achieve truth, but it also makes me think about which experiences do I value. Do I simply ignore, and do I simply discredit any experience which isn't cerebral and thought? But do I realize I'm a spiritual being, I'm a psychological being? There are experiences I don't look at in my head as the sole region for consciousness and experience. I'm not locked in my head. I'm a human being, I'm holistic, I have many experiences. Think about the experiences this year that have really touched you. Many of them haven't really been rational. Why do you feel what you feel? When your spirit moves, what moves your spirit? What were the more spiritual moments of your year this year? One of the questions I ask boys in interviews is, tell me about when you felt your spirit moved religiously. Where were you? When did you feel like Kodesh Baruch Hu? And more often than not, it's not based on learning or thinking. It's based on something that can't be traced to the rational. So the first issue is, how do I acquire truths? Do I try to prove them, or do I receive them? Second question is, what types of experiences do I value and try to pursue? Are they only rational experiences? Are they none? Third of all, I quite honestly don't feel that there's any contradiction between science and between religion. That great question, science and religion, because science operates in a very, very limited realm. It only asks how. It doesn't ask why. And Kabbalah asks why. So there may be perceived points of contradiction, but more or less I can accept every part of science as long as there's a why that Kabbalah provides. Is there evolution? Probably, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu probably created what's called intelligent design, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu created a world like that. How did HaKadosh Baruch Hu create the world in 6 days? I don't know. What is 6 days? Torah talks about 6 days. What is 6 days? So I think that there's this fear in the modern world of science with a capital S. And the moment that science, the all-knowing, omniscient shaper of human identity, seems to conflict with religion, all of a sudden there's a religious crisis. Science exists within a particular realm, answers a certain field of questions. We have to utilize it, we have to, of course, appreciate it, advance it, be enriched by it. And I'll talk about this maybe a little bit later, but so it clips the hubris that sometimes people approach with science. The fourth aspect of where I think it helps is as follows, and this is something I want to be very, very clear about. It is perfectly legitimate to say, I'm going to operate in the rational world, and I'll provide rational solutions and rational experiences, and I'm not a Kabbalah, I'm not even going to study Kabbalah, let alone experience mystical experiences. But what happens when the rational world provides those solutions? What happens when a person is sick, for example, and they perform surgery after surgery, doctor after doctor, research after research, and it just can't be healed? Then you hear about a mukumbal down the block. Who knows that by putting two stones and three pigeons, all of a sudden, it's just an alternate route towards healing. That's all. But like I say, oh, instead of injecting you with this antibiotic, I'll inject you with this antibiotic. Of course you do that. Oh, this antibiotic isn't working. Let's try another cocktail, another antibiotic. So it's just another route. So we can choose to say, normally I'll remain within the world that is reflective of mine. It's not going to be an aberrant, jagged, inconsistent, all of a sudden I use Kabbalah at 10 o'clock and then rationalism at 12 o'clock. I'll put on a red ribbon and I'll have some holy water and madama. That's ridiculous. I'll stick within the world of nigla. I'll paskin based on halacha. I'll consult doctors. I'll consult a psychologist when I feel undue stress about myself and about my life. But what happens when I reach the end of the road? In the world of ration, whether it's the world of halacha, not halacha, but the world of rational thought and rational medicine, and science can't offer solutions. So I've told people, go see a mekubal. It's not copping out. It's not, it's just say, okay, we've exhausted all the options in this doctor's office. Go to the other doctor. Maybe he's got some idea. It's just a different target. It's a different angle towards solving problems. And not just for a medicinal issue, but even a psychological thing bothering you. So you see a psychologist and he helps you, or maybe he doesn't. Maybe you can't get down to the bottom. What's bothering you? And a mekubal is able to see whom you are and understand whom you are. Anyways, you know, there's just an article, again, I was reading it today, just happened to pop up on the Times of Israel or something, that there was a mekubal who accompanied the Israeli army, it's a pretty impressive army, on their tours of the Lebanese border and the Gaza border, and helped them identify close to 30 underground tunnels. How? Well, we would identify them because we'd stick seismic sensors into the ground, we'd tunnel up, we'd use rational tools to try to discover, we'd try to spy on the Arabs digging those tunnels. He is seeing the world through different lenses, like you're looking at it through sunglasses. You're not seeing empirical reality, you're seeing the substrate of that reality. It's just simply like looking at a heat. Like, let's say you want to see if there are people in the building you can't see through. You know, those heat, where you can see these heat maps where you see people's bodies in the movies and you see the red where the people are, infrared, or you're just looking at it through a different light, you're looking at it through a different scanner. So of course he uses a different scanner. It doesn't mean the mekubal is superior. It seems that way. Oh, he couldn't, but the mekubal did. That means the mekubal is superior. Oh, the Rosh Hashiva couldn't, the mekubal did. It just means he has other tools. He's seeing the world through a different lens. He's seeing the world through a different scanner and a different frequency. And sometimes you need that frequency and that perspective because you can't see it rationally. I don't know where tunnels are. Now again, now the army's denying it. I'm just quoting an example. It seems to be pretty credible. It seems to be a lot of people have said, oh, they helped to see all these underground tunnels on the other side and locate their identity and their location. So it's not just as a framer. It helps me frame the limits of ration. It helps me frame the limits of rational experiences and empirical experiences. It helps me appreciate the limits of science. But when a person is in a bind, it's just another address that you normally don't use and normally don't need that you may want to use without feeling as if you're all of a sudden have to apologize. Well, I don't really believe in Kabbalah, but I really need it right now, so please help me out. And the mekubal who will help, but doesn't make them the top of the food chain, doesn't make them the greatest authority. It just means they've got tools that other people don't have. And quite frankly, we don't have the time to develop those tools, and those tools are very, very select, and you have to dedicate your life to it. So he's a specialist. You go to see a specialist, like you'd see a medical specialist. That's the first area in which I think Kabbalah is helpful. To frame and help us qualify ration and rational experiences and science, and even to use everyone's second of all. Kabbalah thinks about all these worlds beyond our world. All these worlds between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and our world. And I think it helps us broaden our space. I think too often we get stuck in this small little space we occupy. Much of human error and moral failures based on pettiness and small-mindedness and what do I need right now and I'm living for the moment and I want to eat and I want this and I want that and I'm angry at this and angry at that one in perspective and seeing that you're part of something larger and that there are worlds beyond your world and we inhabit a very, very small slice of reality. And of course, I don't flee from that small slice of reality because that's the world of reality. That's the slice that I was placed in. So I have to face this world and improve this world and live in this world and advance this world and perform business in this world. But this isn't the only reality. This is not all. Not the only. The entire reality is the universe that physics can trace. Outer space and galaxies. And as far as we can trace, because it's finite. The universe is finite, obviously. Science is conjecturing it isn't, but still, you can, and at some point we can reach the boundary. There are worlds beyond that. So whatever space I'm in, I'm part of larger worlds. And it helps me think about Olam Hazeh, Olam Haba. This is just a transient world. It helps me think, try to be a little bit more humble, that the events of this world are as formative and as important as they seem to us. They're just one small, it's like what's happening in the first grade class down the block. That all of a sudden it changes the world. It's one class of one school of one block of, imagine that our entire world is one first grade class in one school in one little community. Now, I'm obviously exaggerating, but it gives a little perspective as to how you live in this world, and you're not this is not the only part of reality, although it doesn't mean you should flee from reality. I'm not running away, but it helps me sometimes gain a little perspective that there are larger spaces that I'm part of. And when I say part of, not only do they exist, but also I impact them, and that's, I'll get to this a little bit later, but one of the premises of Kabbalah is that your activities can shape those worlds. It's not just a top-down experience where Hashem's presence trickles down, but our experiences shape these upper worlds. So I'm much more activist, and I'll have an impact on those larger worlds. So it doesn't just create the humility and the framing that this is not the only reality, but also makes me feel that my activities matter, and my activities carry ripple effects, and that's the second area that I feel Kabbalah. Number one, it frames ration, it frames empiricism, it frames science for me. It makes me feel like these are important tools. I will develop them, I will apply them, but they're not the only tools. Number two, it frames how I view my world. This is an important world. I occupy the world. It's pretty large as a universe. There's enough for a million lifetimes to explore this universe, but it's just one amongst many. And it limits hubris, and it creates perspective. It reminds me of the transience of Olam Hazeh. Number three, as I said before, Kabbalah accentuates our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu more frequently. You're thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu more directly. Remember, a non-recoupable accepts the distance. I can't understand Hashem. Don't know HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Can't describe Him. The best I can do is obey Him, pray to Him, study His Word, serve His people, be like Him morally. Kabbalah says, no, but I want to know Him. And even if it's not mystical, forget the bridging. Let's not talk about the mysticism. But Kabbalah develops images that apply to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, marriage, husband and wife, Hashem's presence. Hashem is always there in Kabbalah. It's always about how I can understand Hashem. How does, when a non-Makubal looks at a cup of soda, you know what he says? Shako mi'abidwara. When a Makubal looks at a cup of soda, he says, how did Hashem's presence create this cup of soda? So Hashem is much more in the room. Hashem's presence is much more palpable. And that's precisely why the Rambam was opposed to the Kabbalah, or at least the Rambam was opposed to certain strains in Kabbalah, because the Rambam was so opposed to any attempt to create personification or imagery or allegory about a Kadosh Baruch Hu in physical terms. So that's really a collision point between Kabbalah and the Rambam. The Rambam doesn't say I'm against Kabbalah, but when he rails in the Marni Ruchim against personification of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, he's essentially disagreeing frontally with Kabbalah's attempt to make a Kadosh Baruch Hu more palpable, more. Let me give you an example that has nothing to do with Kabbalah. When I raised my children, I tried to speak a lot about HaKadosh Baruch Hu at a very early age with them in a way that compromised Him theologically. I wanted my children to think that Hashem was their father in Shemayim, and Hashem was, I went out, that Hashem gave me some food from the Makola, that Hashem. I said, you know what, I'd rather they feel Hashem's palpable presence, and later I'll update it that Hashem didn't give me the loaf of bread. I went to the Makolan and bought it, and Hashem didn't give me the sefer, but I learned it on my own, and I got it from the Sarim store. But the cost of the distance sometimes can lead to Hashem fading out of consciousness. In the world of Kabbalah, Hashem's always there. It's always about finding His presence, locating, tracing, where is Hashem, unifying His presence, L'Hashem Yichukut Shebrichu, trying to unify His presence. So that's the third advantage. When you read Kabbalah,
all of a sudden Hashem becomes much more vivid, much more, and it helps remind me when I'm studying non-Kabbalah, Maseches Pesachim, I have to make sure Hashem's there. It's not just about studying the Tosafot and the calculus and the analysis. Do I feel that it's Dvar Hashem? And I'm giving tzedakah, do I feel that it's Rosh Hashem? When I'm davening, do I feel the presence of Hashem? These are the ways that it bleeds. I'm not a practicing Mekubal, but these are accent points or points of emphasis in Kabbalah that when you apply them to the world of non-Kabbalah, help you, even in your world of non-Kabbalah, maximize your avodas Hashem. Number four, Kabbalah sees man, as I said this before, in an activist stance. We're not just passive victims of this large cosmos who are just simply obeying, not just simply obeying HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but I can make a difference. My simple action, even the simple action of smiling, saying hello, thank you, dipping in the mikvah, making the bracha the right way, counting the sphere the right way, all of a sudden, the cosmos is churning. All of a sudden, the gears are turning. All of a sudden, upper worlds and upper realms, I'm studying Torah, I'm reshaping reality because I'm affecting the most upper realm, and Torah is the first emanation from HaKadosh Baruch Hu's infinity, and all of a sudden it emanates. And my Daf Gemara is affecting people in China. Because the world is on more solid footing, because my Torah, bottom up, affects that highest realm, closest to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's infinity, then supplies welfare and prosperity to the entire. So it creates an empowerment to human activity. Human beings are also in the center point of Kabbalah, because it's this human attempt to unify HaKadosh Baruch Hu's disparate, scattered presence and create a different cosmos that's more reflective of the original cosmos. And that's something we talk about a lot with changing the world and learning Torah and what's your pshat in the Gemara and feeling ki, saying chalkeinu b'sarisecha. I think that sometimes in a non-Kabbalistic world, the world of halacha and religion can feel very stiff and very established, and you just follow the rules. You just follow your... That's what's so dangerous about Kabbalah, because you could become too empowered and become too insolent and not respectful enough. But I think it creates an empowerment, and that's why the world of Hasidus was so influential over the world of Zionism, because the world of Hasidus talked about being actively involved in redemption. Nusach Svar. Who davens Nusach Svar here? Anyone daven Nusach Svar? So if you daven Nusach Ashkenaz, Rav Yonenu, Avrivar Yvenu, Ugyalenu. Mehera Laman Shemecha. What's Nusach Svar? Ugyalenu, Ku'ula Shlema, Mehera Laman Shemecha. There's more of a sense that I have to redeem the world. The world isn't static. I have to change the world. Esamach David Abdecha Meres Atzmech Vekarno Tarmishu Asecha Kili Shu Ascha Kivinu Kalayam. That's where Nesach Ashkenaz ends. What's Nesach Svar? Oh, but Tzapim Lishua. I don't just wait, I really wait. Kili Shu Ascha Kivinu Kalayam. Oh, but Tzapim Lishua. Yizkadal Yizkadal Shemer Abba V'yimad Yivrach Yisrael Melech Melech Hosei B'chayichanu V'yimachan B'chayidu Rabbi Yisrael. I skipped it. Yizkadal Yizkadal Shemer Abba V'yimad Yivrach Yisrael Melech Melech Hosei. We stop. We want to coronate Hashem. What's Nesach Svar? The Yatzmach Perkane V'Karev Kes Meshiche. I don't just want to coronate Hashem, I want to advance redemption. I want to advance Gula. I'll talk about what are the terms of Gula. You all mourn, or we all mourn, for the Beis HaMikdash primarily once a year, Tisha B'Av. A Mekubal gets up every night at midnight and mourns for Yerushalayim and says Tikkun Leil Chatzos and thinks about redemption and yearns and churns, and then, you know what, tomorrow I have to make sure that I'm a little bit closer than we were the day before. Because when I sit down and take the lechatzos tomorrow, I want us to be closer to redemption of the world. So it's an activist, redemptive stance to change the world, not just geographically and nationalistic, which I'll talk about, but to change the entire cosmos. That's the fourth way that I think Kabbalah enhances my relationship. And the fifth way, and with this we'll conclude, is as follows. There is a universalism to Kabbalah, and I'll describe it momentarily. But I've talked with you so often this year how Avodas Hashem is threading that balance between parochialism, nationalism, Jewish activity, mitzvahs, Torah, ritual, Eretz Yisrael, Jews, Jewish community, but not falling into bigotry or racism or xenophobia, to know that a Jew's responsibility is to the entire world, and the way he serves that responsibility is by being the best Jew we can. And every black Gemara you learn is to advance humanity. And every hilltop you settle in Eretz Yisrael is trying to somehow get us closer to that Mashiach that will change the entire world or bring prosperity for all B'nai Adam, not as Jews, but as human beings. And so much of our Jewish world is polarized today. So many Jews are becoming insular and parochial and nationalistic and Torah-oriented. And there's almost a hatred and a bigotry against non-Jews. They're meaningless. And chalila b'chas.
I think I told you this last week. I forgot what I told you, what I didn't tell you. I was a rabbi in a Pesach program over Pesach. And one night I said, we're saying Tehillim, between Kali members, between Chamarev. Someone came over, who's sick, who's ill? You don't normally say Tehillim on Yom Tov. I said, 500 people were killed in Sri Lanka, 350, who knows, 300 were killed, 500 maimed. How can we celebrate Zman Chayr Seder and our birth as a people, Bnei Avraham, Yitzchak, V'Yaakov, and not say Tehillim for all these innocent people? So to be a complete Yid is to be an Oved Hashem in the narrow sense, but to realize that that narrow experience also impacts the entire world. And of course, there's some Jews today that are so universalistic and so pluralistic and so that sense of chosen people, chosen for responsibility, chosen for mission, that's so offensive to them. And you have to find that middle space where you feel chosen, but it doesn't lock you into a parochial position. If anything, it makes you the biggest universalist. Kabbalah is universalist. Let me explain. When we talk about redemption, non-mukubalah, so we think about redemption at two levels. Primarily the redemption of our people. We were perfect. We had this opportunity for immediate redemption. We were chosen. We received Hashem's word. We received Hashem's Torah. And we fell. Diego, the Meraglim, Beis HaMikdash Rishon, from Beis HaMikdash. So that whole fall of the Jewish people, starting from Diego, we want to recover, Chadesh HaMeinu Kekedem, reverse the clock, walk backwards in history. And we know of another fall, not just the fall of the Jewish people, but the fall of man. Man fell. Adam HaRishon, sin, disobeyed HaKadosh Baruch. Now, they could be separate narratives, you can collapse the narrative. Adam fell, and Am Yisrael had a chance to recover from Adam's fall, so essentially the fall of Adam was repeated by the fall of the Jewish people. But when we talk about Gula, we talk about our people returning to our land, receiving and reinstituting HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah for the entire world, to see Hashem's will. In the world of Kabbalah, there's a prior fall, and it isn't moral. And it isn't human. Hashem created this cosmos, and Hashem's essence is unified, and Hashem is indivisible, and somehow this cosmos was not capable of fully containing Hashem's indivisible essence, and Hashem's presence became scattered. That's called the Nitzotzos, without getting into Kabbalah. This world doesn't reflect HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And my responsibility is to redeem this world and make it more similar to Hashem. And when integrating Hashem's presence in this world, it's more reflective of Hashem's indivisibility. That's a very, very universal experience. I'm not only thinking about how quickly can I make Aliyah and how quickly can Mashiach come. I'm thinking in terms that will affect not just Jews and not even humanity. It will affect the cosmos. And it reminds me that even when I'm learning a Blad Gemara or even when I'm saying a Perek of Tehillim, which feels very ritualistic and various people say tribal, it's a universal moment because I'm trying to shape the cosmos. I'm not just trying to redeem Jewish people and not even just trying to redeem people. I'm trying to redeem the cosmos, and it reminds me to always seek that universalist tone even when I'm involved in what seems to be a very, very specific, parochial, national Blad Gemara, saying Tehillim, davening, living in Israel, that the stakes are larger and cosmological. Those are the five areas that I think Kabbalah affects my life. Number one, framing rationalism in general. Number two, framing the world. Number three, introducing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's palpable presence. Number four, that I have an impact to change the world. And number five, that I have a responsibility to a broader reality beyond my people and even beyond my race, not just human beings, but to the cosmos at large. There are certain times I feel Kabbalah more deeply. One of the three, four times a year, there's certainly Sfiros Omer is tethered to the world of Kabbalah because the Sfiros 7x7 is so reflective of the wise network. That's why people say Hod Shebahar, Hod Shebechesed. I don't say it because I don't really know what those specific terms mean, and I have too much respect for Kabbalah just to rattle off phrases and just to interpret them in non-Kabbalistic terms. So people want to give up shot. Today's the X day of the Omer, Hod Shebechesed, the beauty of Chesed. All these terms are deeply resonant with iconic meaning that are part of systems, and I don't want to all of a sudden tarnish, or I don't say those phrases because I just have too much respect for Kabbalah. I know that I don't know anything about these, so I first want to study them before I rattle them off, but I am aware that during Sfira, counting down to Matan Torah, which is really the consolidation of our world, is a Kabbalistic-like experience. I feel very deeply Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, where obviously the stakes of my experience and who I am as a person rise, and the world is being judged, and I'm living outside of myself, and it's not just day-to-day routine, and what am I going to eat for dinner, and what am I... I feel it on Shabbos. Obviously, Shabbos is beyond time, beyond place, creation, how the world was created. I feel it, obviously, during learning, because of the Nefesh HaChaim, we studied the Nefesh HaChaim, some of us studied after Davening, where Torah is that upper realm and every blood. This is the 3-4 times I feel Kabbalah, very, very remotely. I don't have no other terms. I don't study that actively. But I feel as if there's something larger in my Talmud Torah. There's something different in my Shabbos. I'm not just following the halachas of Rosh Hashanah, but having some larger impact. I'm not just counting down sphere, but there's something larger. But in general, I try to use it to frame my experience. So these are the two agendas. First of all, just be educated. Don't oversimplify. Don't make these negative, scornful statements. It's humiliating. Well, it's part of a Masara. All of our Gadol, you can't, tomorrow you're going to read a Ramban Ram Sachin. I'll say, oh, I don't believe in Kabbalah. Ramban would be laughing at you. Literally laughing in tears. I don't believe in Kabbalah. Kabbalah is all bomb. It's all hocus pocus. No, it's a deep-seated part of a Masara. It can be studied. Certain, I won't say marginal, but certainly minority strains didn't just study it, but also engage in mystical experiences. It comes from even pre-Har Sinai, Avram, just like Avram's word of Torah Shebal Peh, but certainly from Har Sinai. It becomes institutionalized and swarmed throughout the ages. And I think that a lot of people, because of some of the modern incarnations of Lag BaOmer and Mishneh Bar Yochai, forget Lag BaOmer. This is just a shiur to make you appreciate Kabbalah on Yud Teshvat or your Yom Kislev, or whatever, Gimel Sivan. Any day you pick, Kabbalah is part of our world and may not be part of our practicing day-to-day experience. Okay? Happy Lag BaOmer, everyone. Enjoy the barbecue. Stay in the world of Nigla. Enjoy the mango. But not for us in the world of Nigla. Don't all of a sudden run off, but certainly not with this modern sense. Okay? Shekach, guys. You're welcome.